Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. Eric Topol, an internationally recognized thought leader in the areas of genomics and wireless technology. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at the state of telemedicine in 2012. And we begin with this week's Bright Idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
The human genome was only recently fully mapped, but already it's changing the way scientists and the average person are thinking about their health. A few short years ago, getting a personal gene mapping could cost up to $250,000. But now, with the price becoming reasonable for individuals, you can have your personal genetic code unraveled to determine your potential for a variety of diseases. And that has spawned a whole new crop of citizen scientists, armed with their own personal genetic information, to share this information and ultimately have an impact on public health. Melanie Swan founded DIYgenomics.org to provide a platform for interested citizen scientists to share their genetic data and crowdsource information. That idea being that they can offer scientists pre-aggregated communities of patients and healthy individuals, willing to share their information for research on disease identification markers and hopefully generate potential faster routes to cures and prevention. Since the internet has accelerated the ability to crowdsource information and genetics testing has become available to the mainstream, she saw this as not only a way to empower the average person to become proactive about their personal health, but improve the public health as well. DIYgenomics.org is already conducting several studies on everything from heart disease markers to staving off dementia, and they are teaming up with scientists to validate the shared information for faster dissemination in the medical community. Millions are expected to be participating in social health networks as the population continues to age, providing a goldmine of essential data for medical research. Personal genomics testing for one's own health and sharing that information with science for the betterment of public health, now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Eric Topol, a leading proponent in the use of genomics and wireless technologies to revolutionize medicine and improve health outcomes. He's the director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute and vice chair of the West Wireless Health Institute, whose mission is to find effective ways to reduce healthcare costs. Dr. Topol, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. It seems we're on the frontier of a new era in medicine, and you were a keynote speaker at the recent mHealth Summit and are considered a visionary and thought leader in applying emerging technologies like mobile and genomics to the practice of medicine. But what's your vision for how these technologies can revolutionize healthcare?
Yes, well, this is what I would consider, you know, an extraordinary time, the most exciting time ever in medicine. I've been a student of its progress for almost three decades, but I would qualify this as a veritable kairos, you know, the supreme opportune moment, just because we have this amazing digital infrastructure and superimposed in the ability to intersect that with the medical applications of that.
Dr. Topol, in your book, The Creative Destruction of Medicine, you talk about the explosion of technology and entering the era of the digitized patient. And I was struck by the persistent theme of individualized medicine based on individual genomics that you see as one of the hugely promising areas. But I think it comes right when much of the healthcare community has just gotten comfortable with the concept of population medicine or planning and delivering health services based on understanding the data and the risks and the outcomes of groups of people or populations. So these are two pretty different approaches. How do you think healthcare, not just medicine, but public health and policy is going to reconcile and embrace these two very different approaches?
Well, you definitely zoomed in on the overarching theme of the book, which is we have this newfound potential to understand each individual in a high-definition granularity way we've never had before. That's the real extraordinary opportunity. That's the big difference today. You know, we couldn't sequence a human genome before in a matter of hours and in an affordable way and being able to interpret it. We couldn't track any physiologic metric, whether it's blood pressure, glucose, any vital sign, brainwaves, anything you can think of, continuously, remotely, and image things of any part of the body, you know, with handheld high-resolution scanning equipment. So these things, in addition to health information systems, give us the ability to understand each person. You know, we're used to digitizing books and periodicals and even movies, but to do that for people, for persons, is a newfound, very unique time in our lives. And that's what really is the rebooting, this creative destruction idea, is that this goes beyond an innovative, disruptive force. This is something we've never been able to do before.
You know, I'm fascinated by the concept of creative destruction. I'm not sure it's a new term. It sounds like a Buddhist term. and you say it's a necessary starting point for the transformation that accompanies radical innovation. You make the point that our world of social networking and connectivity has been dramatically altered by digital devices, but in healthcare, not so much, right?
You know, it's really sobering regarding how difficult it is to change things in the medical community. You know, one of the greatest examples is the stethoscope, the icon of medicine, introduced in 1816. It took 20 years for that to be used by doctors in a wide-scale basis. And the same, now 200 years later, it takes 17 years is the average for, you know, new things to get incorporated into daily practice. So here we have this, you know, unparalleled opportunity, this newfound, you know, power to understand each individual to change medicine. And the reason that I put the book together was, in fact, because my sense that we could do this within the medical community appears to be virtually impossible. We need the pressure to be exerted from consumer activism, I think, particularly in a world where there's just this phenomenal capability of social networking to bring people together to force change that's appropriate.
So, Dr. Topol, as you've clearly laid out, the mapping of the human genome, the digitizing of the patients can radically alter the way we treat patients going forward. But as you know, based on your own clinical background, how we treat patients is half the battle, and how patients engage with their own care and make changes is the other half of the battle that remains one of the areas to solve. What's the interaction of patients with this whole area of genomic medicine in your experience?
Yes, that's a great point about to be a participatory, whereby individuals say, you know, I need to know a specific part about my genomic data. And the first place where that really comes up is in taking medications. So what we have now is the capability for many of the most commonly prescribed drugs to find out before the drug is ever taken, the first pill, whether or it might induce a very serious side effect or whether it actually will work in that individual. You know, will it be efficacious? So this is an opportunity for people, before they start a prescription, to say to their doctor, what about a genotype with respect to my DNA and how it will interact with that medicine, avoiding a lot of waste and, perhaps even more importantly, avoiding what can be very serious, even fatal side effects. Let me give you one example of that. In the country Taiwan, you can't get a prescription for Tegretol now, which is a very commonly used drug for many different neurologic conditions. But you can't get that drug prescription unless you get a genotype because of a potentially fatal side effect, which is called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. Whereas in the United States, no one gets genotypically screened.
We're speaking today with Dr. Eric Topol, world-renowned cardiologist and thought leader in the area of genomics, translational medicine, and wireless medicine. You just mentioned the area of safety, and certainly that's one area we like to focus in, but we also like to address making healthcare more affordable. Something you're committed to at the West Wireless Health Institute, as healthcare costs continue to rise, how much will these technologies cost to implement, and how will they be? How will they impact efficiency and cost?
You know, that's a vital issue. You know, whether we can ever break this link that seems to be inextricable, whereby you have new technology, high tech, and then you have high cost. And how can we turn this around where we have this technologic revolution, whereas for the first time that it can lower costs? We have evidence of that today. At the mHealth Summit, I demonstrated actually on myself a couple of technologies. For one, that does your cardiogram on the phone, basically for free.
We're excited about
yes,
that
we
one.
Are.
and you know, I do that for all my patients. I'm as a cardiologist, I don't you order cardiograms now. I just take my phone out and do the cardiogram on the phone and send that quickly to be deposited for the record. And the same thing with an echocardiogram. I don't even listen to the heart anymore because the portable echo, the V-scan that I use, I don't need to, send patients except under unusual circumstances to get a full expensive echocardiogram. This is just part of the physical exam. It's free. And so, in terms of the cost to the patient and the cost to our overall healthcare burden. So these are things that I use today that I think already demonstrate that new technology, markedly lower costs. I mean, there are over 20 million echocardiograms done each year. So there's at least several $1 billion could be saved just for that one use of ultrasound technology. So the opportunities here for cutting costs are really, I consider, remarkable.
Dr. Topol, as you may know, we devote a lot of attention with our guests to thinking about health reform as it's unfolding in the United States, and certainly to looking at the Affordable Care Act. And many say that the act is so deep and bulky, everything's in there but the proverbial kitchen sink, metaphorically speaking. But it doesn't seem to me that beyond electronic health records and the exchange of healthcare information through exchanges, which vitally important developments. But beyond that, I don't recall so much attention devoted to some of these areas that you see as absolutely vital to quality and cost in the future, genomics, the digitized patients. What's your take on the Affordable Care Act relative to these areas? Were there things that you felt really should have been in there that were left out or not given sufficient attention?
Well, virtually everything we've been talking about was omitted from the Affordable Care Act. There was, of course, some attention to health information systems and information technology, electronic medical records. But as far as genomic, as far as wireless sensors, advanced resolution, pocket miniature imaging devices, those sorts of things, these technologies were not incorporated. The concept of digitizing human beings wasn't even, mentioned in that 2,000-plus page
bill. But isn't it fair to say that in the stimulus bill, there was the HITECH Act, which provided the sort of the foundational dollars for people to go to electronic health records? So in some ways, we talked about this a little earlier, that there was such, they're all poor habits in terms of medicine around technology. But I think somebody must have been realizing this isn't, while they're on one hand, there's revolutionaries like you in terms of technology and genomics. On the other hand, there are Luddites who really simply don't have the basics of an EHR to receive the wireless transmission.
That's right. There was, as I mentioned, the one thing that on the digital medicine front that was incorporated was, as you say, HITECH, which is about electronic medical records, which is going to be a slow process. It already, planned a $40 billion to be spent on that, and it's not clear how much that's going to improve. But I think the other part that offered tremendous opportunities, just going back to genomics for a moment, in cancer therapy, we've already learned in a few types of cancer how knowing the driver mutation can lead to the appropriate therapy and cures, the likes of which we haven't seen ever before. So the question is, why don't we have a national program where all patients with a new diagnosis of cancer get sequencing of their tumor, get sequencing of their native DNA, their so-called germline DNA, find the driver mutations, and basically make a whole different look of how cancer is treated. If this was done in a wiki collaborative way, we would be well far along, and it wouldn't take nearly the kinds of funds that have to be put in for that electronic medical records to accomplish that task.
Let me just sort of jump in one more time on this, because it sounds like on one hand, you're a wiki, Google-like, flat revolutionary, and on the other hand, you're sort of talking about what the government needs to do. So what's the balance here? Where do you see yourself falling out in terms of who's going to lead this transformation?
Yeah, this is a public-based consumer health revolution, I think, that has to unfold. This is not going to come from the government and certainly not going to come from the medical community. But we have learned from examples of, for example, pharmaceutical company direct-to-consumer advertising, that the consumers can drive their own care. And if we start getting that type of Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street type movements towards healthcare, and towards a new precise way to render care and, you know, move towards the whole axis of prevention, which is possible when you know everything about a person that's relevant. Then I think, you know, we can achieve this. I mean, I think that was the purpose of why I put in the effort to, you know, to do a book, just because I thought, well, finally, maybe we can actually get the activism here, which is potentiated now to a level, you know, we've never seen. Each week, there's been another article, which is just amazing. Like, one was, do patients have a right to access their laboratory data?
Right.
I say, how can you even ask that question? Then the week before that, it was, do patients have a right to their genomic data? And this is really embodies the problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's the medical community doesn't even think that people should have right to their own DNA, to their, you know, data. I mean, something's wrong with this picture and this paternalistic doctor knows best attitude. We have to get over that.
Well, those are great points. And we've certainly had some very interesting discussions with colleagues about the right to lab data. But looks like that one's been decided for everybody and the patients have that right. So that's terrific.
Well, yeah, we're not seeing only there's only like one health system that actually makes that real, Kaiser. But for the most part, most people can't access their lab data. And this week, you know, you probably saw the Annals of Internal Medicine papers about sharing the medical chart, the doctor's notes. And again, another example, why shouldn't people have the right to access their notes? And why are we asking these questions in 2011?
I noted in your book, and you didn't spend a lot of time on this, but you made the point that it really now is within the power of the consumer to have their genetic code mapped, that you don't have to have an order for it, and it's not out of the price range of everybody in the country. It's not something that only the very wealthy could do. And yeah, I noted when I read that, interesting, but most people have not.
Well, there's two points there. One is like we're kind of right in the middle of where before you could only get a genome-wide scan, which is just looking at a million markers and, you know, not providing that much insight. And that was where the consumer genomics companies got started in late 2007. And we're right at this transition to whole genome sequencing. So the question is, well, why bother with a scan right now for a few hundred dollars when you could have your whole genome sequence every one of the 6 billion letters and get a whole lot more information. So that's one part of this. The other one is that the American Medical Association, and I did write about this in the book, has doing everything they can to lobby the government to prevent people accessing their data.
Right.
And this is a problem because, you know, like I said, we're right in this transition where it's a very rich opportunity to get everything you could possibly know about your own sequence of DNA. And patients did very well to know their genome-wide scan data. Thousands of patients that we studied did perfectly fine without psychological trauma. But still, the AMA is taking that on, lobbying the FDA for people not to have their data directly, but only ordered through physicians.
Well, you know, Dr. Topol, we're talking about change that has to go deep. And all this radical change also requires us to think about pretty big change in the education and training of the health professionals, right? And the health profession students. And we know if clinical medicine and nursing and the other professions are slow to change, the education can be even slower. What are you doing at Scripps? How is your work fundamentally transforming medical education to embrace this new arena?
Well, we do things to educate the medical community on genomics, and we have had specific programs whereby, for example, the very commonly used drug Plavix, where we got all the physicians that are involved in treating patients with Plavix educated about genotyping, and so that when patients have a stent placed, that they know that they're going to get genotyped, and the medication, the regimen they get is going to be affected by that information. So we're doing the same now for hepatitis, for the gastroenterologists and internists who treat those patients with respect to their drug interferon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping soon in the new year to start another program in diabetes genomics. So that is our plan, is not to try to do it all, but, you know, with specific programs, the right physicians and healthcare professionals are working in that to get them up to speed and to hopefully buy into a new order of medicine.
Dr. Topol, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's different fronts. I mean, I think there's many centers now that are starting to figure out that genomics can make an enormous difference in how we approach patients. So, you know, there's many centers throughout the U.S. And abroad that are focused on that. I mean, we're starting to see this movement from, you know, gene hunting research to now, you know, applying that information in the practice of medicine. And then, on the other hand, in parallel, there is a similar thing with the biosensor movement, which was in health and fitness, but is just now getting into the whole medical sphere. And so we haven't seen it integrated yet. That's, you know, one of the unusual vantage points that we have in La Jolla, because we've got these different institutes working together. So that whole idea of this panoramic view of each individual, you know, there isn't enough of that going on yet, but hopefully it will in the near future.
Today we've been speaking with Dr. Eric Topol, leading proponent in the use of genomics, director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute, and vice chair of the West Wireless Health Institute. Dr. Topol, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us on Conversations.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
What are the top tech trends in healthcare in 2012? Jonathan Linkous, CEO of the American Telemedicine Association, the largest nonprofit organization linking players in the telemedicine arena, recently outlined seven of the top trends in telemedicine we're likely to see. More remote monitoring of the chronically ill patient, for one.
Well, it's been proven for a long time that remote monitoring, combined with some care management of regularly monitoring the patient and helping them care for themselves, yields tremendous benefits, not only in their own health benefits, but also in tremendously reduced costs.
Linkous says, don't be fooled by all the gee whiz technology exploding out there. The truth is, very few of the multitude of applications will find their way into the mainstream. One area expected to grow, remote patient diagnosis en route to hospital, vastly improving survival for, say, heart attack victims.
You're put into an ambulance going to the emergency room, they'll take an EKG, and the EKG will be transmitted by cell phone to the attending physician in the emergency room. So by the time you get there, they have some early tests and ideas of what the situation is and the patient is coming in. It really helps change your, frankly, your survival.
There is big growth expected in robot use in hospitals. For instance, a decade ago, robotic surgery was cutting edge. Now it's mainstream. The next horizon, robots doing rounds, where doctors can handle grand rounds remotely through a roving robot.
They can go up and down the hall with this movable robot that'll go to the patient's bed, talk to the patient. He'll have his picture there on the screen and the robot. They'll have this interaction back and forth, and then he moves on to the next bed.
If it sounds too futuristic, it's already being used in some hospital settings, and numerous studies show patients quickly adapt to the interaction. Remote operation of intensive care units is also a big growth trend for hospitals. About 10% of the nation's hospitals are already using so-called intensivists.
About 10% of all the intensive care beds in the United States are looked at and monitored by an intensivist, a specialist who focuses on the needs and the care and knows exactly what to do for somebody in the ICU, but they do that from a distance.
One technology that will also see growth moving forward in 2012, implants. Patients will have tiny chip implants that can monitor their vitals 24/7, their data being uploaded to their doctor via their cell phone.
You're constantly getting monitoring of your vital signs. It could anything be from your glucose to your pulse oximetry, the oxygen in your blood, to your temperature, and all of these things. You'll have a little, your own personal little dashboard. You'll be able to check on how you are.
Linkous says the explosion of new applications in mobile technology and the smartphone applications being developed are not only going to save lives, but serious money as well. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this Tech Report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is a Connecting Our Communities initiative from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.